Welcome to another episode of The Breakdown. For anybody who's been paying any kind of attention to Alberta politics for the last couple of months, the UCP is having a leadership race. Now, one of the things that we're trying to do is we're going to try to make sure that we sit down with every candidate who's running for the UCP leadership in a long form interview so they have the opportunity to explain their positions and why they believe that they should be what will quite literally be the next premier of Alberta, because once the race is over, the UCP still hold government for at least a few months. We've extended invitations out to every candidate. We've heard back from some, but the very first one to get back to us and in an extraordinarily timely matter is none other than the mayor of
Amisk.
Oh, it's the S that gets me. I told you I'd mispronounce it. The mayor of Amisk, Bill Rock. Bill, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Nate. I appreciate it. We love your work.
Oh, thank you. So to start with, for clarity, because the odds are very good that this field will evolve. There will be all kinds of interesting little dynamics that pop up at Alberta Politics. We're recording this on Monday, June the 20th, give or take 7:30 p.m. But I just wanted to get that on the record because who knows what's going to happen. But before we get too far into the UCP stuff, Bill, will you tell our audience who is Bill Rock?
Well, Bill Rock, I'm a small town mayor. I was elected to be a councillor 8 years ago. I've gone through three election cycles in our village. And in this particular last one, we were actually acclaimed. First time in the history of Amos, they have not had an election. They acclaimed us into position. So I took that as a good sign that, you know, I'd been there for 8 years doing a job for, you know, for the village for 8 years, and they wanted to keep me. The other thing is, a small business owner in the village, we have a plumbing and heating company as well as a convenience store. We're right on Highway 13, get the plug in there, big happy face, the happiest place in now Alberta. I'm in people's homes every day, you know, and we see 150 people come through our store every day. We see, you know, the working people and, you know, the single moms, the seniors, you know. So I run in 2015. There's been some issues with politics for many years. Got involved back in 2011 with the Wild Rose Party, run as a candidate in Wetaskiwin Camrose in 2015. The last couple of years of the COVID, we started off, and I got to thank the UCP government, you know, and all the government for, you know, the first part of the COVID. You know, they acted quickly. There was a lot of really good response, worked really hard with municipalities to keep communities safe. And that was the number one goal, keep communities safe. But then we kind of hit a wall there, and I don't know what the wall was. Nobody, you know, it turned into something that, now we were locked down, and, you know, the lockdowns at the beginning, you know, and I told the people, you know, this is 2 weeks, a month, you know, and then we'll get this under control. And, you know, then I had to go back and tell them, oh, and now it's 6 months, you know. And then I guess the one that really kind of really put me kind of out there on the warpath was I had to go down to the local church, the high school, the seniors' home, and tell them that, no, you're not going to be able to have a Christmas concert. You're not going to be able to, you know, your family can't come and visit. You can't go to your families, because as municipal elected officials, we also look after our seniors. And, 3 days later, I find out that a whole bunch of government officials are jet setting off around the world for Christmas. That didn't sit well with a person like me, you know. So, you know, I started writing letters, and, I wrote about mental health to our MLAs and our MPs and, you know, premier and stuff. And because I'm in people's homes every day, and we see the people coming through the store, I've seen the impacts of mental health. So now we're coming out of this whole thing, and a lot of us on the municipal level had said, you know, these are the problems we're going to run into. And it seemed like all of a sudden there was a blind ear to what us municipal people were doing. There's 2,700 of us across the province in 270 communities. And, you know, I've talked to my colleagues and, you know, they're kind of saying the same thing. So we went through a bad ambulance situation in our community here about 3 months ago. We met, you know, with Alberta Health Services and you know, the answers we were getting for better ambulance service, you know, 40 of us in the room, none of us believe that those are going to solve the problems, right? You know, then we stepped into all of a sudden, because we're two kids short in our whole school, now all of a sudden they're cutting our grade three teacher to 0.7 hours and our teaching assistants for the handicapped kids to 0.7 hours. And, you know, just up the road, they've closed a school that had, you know, has a town of 500. We have an emergency room that's been closed for 2 years with no reopen date. So, you know, the problems in rural Alberta were really starting to mount. And I've got a pretty loud voice because 5 years ago we had a, you know, our rural crime really escalated. So, you know, I've been able to meet with every minister of justice since then. Head of RCMP for Alberta, sheriff's departments, and, you know, we formed rural crime watch groups. So I had a few people that were going, well, you know, maybe you should get involved in this. And it was a big debate, but here I am.
Now, I got to ask, it's a provincial party leadership is that's a pretty big job. And especially when you're talking about the governing party, is there a reason why you went for this before going for a role as an MLA? I mean, I'm in no way trying to diminish your experiences as mayor for 8 years, because I grew up in a small town and I get that small town politics is a very different game than big city politics. But some people might see it as a big leap. So is there a reason why? Is it just the timing?
Well, more of the timing. And I know a lot of MLAs, you know, we are at a lot of meetings together. And I've been a small business owner many years, you know, so I've always been in a leadership role. I've been in a leadership role since I probably was in high school, sort of idea. So, not saying that I can't be a team player, because I've supported many MLAs and that's how they get a lot of information. No, I believe that we need a change at the top. We need somebody that, you know, like a friend of mine said, somebody that signs the front of paychecks, that has to make the hard decisions and live with the decisions that you make. It seems, you know, that's the problem with government, I guess, is, you know, they could make any decision they want because they're not the ones that are suffering the consequences some days.
You talked a little bit at the beginning there about the frustration, and it's, you know, there's so many people who have put a pin in this particular moment, and it's the Christmas Aloha Gate, as some people have taken to call it. That was for a lot of people, the moment where they lost a lot of faith in the current government. So I guess the obvious question that I have to ask is, how would you do things differently? How would you have prevented staff and MLAs from traveling?
Well, we had keep the same set of rules for the general public as it is for your people. We were working with two sets of rules. Their rules and the rules for the rest of you. You can't have that. You know, it's like with my guys, you know, safety rules are safety rules, and I have to follow them just as well as they follow them.
Okay. Would you have expelled the staffers who traveled? Would you have terminated their employment? The MLAs who traveled some in flagrant violation of the same rules that were set up for Albertans, would you have removed them from caucus?
That probably would have been more serious if I'd been there. It would, you know, I because the people that did it were the ones that were telling us municipal people what to do, right? They were, you know, they were reading one rule book and making plans on the other hand. So yeah, I probably would have been a lot more serious if I'd been in that position. And I do realize they're elected officials, but this is why we've talked about this recall, and we have it on our policy page, an effective recall. If your constituents had decided that, you know, boy, you really made a mistake, we want to recall you, we would have given them the opportunity to recall. And that's just the way, you know, an effective recall. And I don't know whether you've read our recall policy on our page or not.
It's, I mean, there's no question that the UCP's recall legislation is at best performative, because by most standards, it's entirely unattainable. It seems like that was just a ticky box that they wanted to put up so they could say that they did. But I want to talk a little bit more about you. So you said that you got involved with the Wild Rose in 2011. Yes. Are you like a lifelong conservative? Have you lived in Amisk for your entire life? What's the story?
Well, I'm a lifelong conservative, but that's the way I was brought up, conservative. I grew up in small town, grew up on the farm, you know, grew up, I've had a business of one sort or another since I was 16 years old. I've taken a few tours off to you know, work with big corporations. I was a college instructor in Fairview in Northwest, and also the Northwest Territories at one time. So yeah, I've been a conservative. I understand the politics of the socialists is I have problems with. I do believe that the communities need to look after their own, and a way to gauge society is how you treat your most least fortunate people. But as far as a willing or able embodied people working, contributing to society, I don't think anybody should just be sitting back and writing. So yeah, I guess you would say I'm a conservative, but I've always, you know, a good conservative will look out for their neighbor, you know, and help their neighbor. Like I say, if you look at the hours I put in with the village of Amisk and my paycheck, it's a labor of love, that one, for our community. It's not about getting rich, you know, so.
Would you, as somebody who's, I mean, I love that you threw Fairview in there because that's where I grew up. so, you know, there's that. But as a lifelong conservative, are you, you know, we've seen a lot of terminology thrown around in the UCP leadership race. We've certainly seen a lot of terminology thrown around since the UCP started campaigning when they became a thing. Would you describe yourself as like a rule of law conservative? Are you a big like subscriber to social contract? Is that the kind of conservatism that you would say that you practice?
Social contract. That one I don't know. What do you?
So it's just the idea that in any society you have to play by the rules that the society has because you benefit from that society.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I will agree with that. Yes. Okay. You know, at times, yes, the rules do need to change, but you know, let's change them with some sort of sense and common sense. I can tell you a story about, you know, One of my counselors, we were in a meeting, and they wanted us to come up with a whole bunch of brand new policies and, you know, spend tens of thousands of dollars on policies. And he just turned to the, you know, the person and said, you know, we just have one policy around here. It's called common sense. You know, why do we need to write a whole bunch of stuff down on paper? Let's get back to some real common sense, you know, organizations.
I suspect the answer for that is probably the same reason that they have to put do not eat on silica gel. But there's always someone, in my experience.
I love reading some of those things, you know, like you go, well, somebody had to have done this, you know.
Yep. No, for every rule, there's somebody who made a bad choice, in my experience. Now, you talked a little bit about the rural education system. And this is an area that has been very heated in provincial politics. We just saw the Alberta Teachers Association accept a mediated contract by a knife's edge of a vote. And one of the big beefs that was in that contract had to do with teaching hours, which you mentioned at the beginning, and it also had to do with class sizes. So let's say that you win the race, you're the new premier of Alberta. Are those items that you're going to work to address, or are those items that you're going to save for after the election? Where do they sit on your priority list?
Very high. I'll tell you this, if I win and I become premier, I got 5 months to get policies out there and get those policies working before the next election. You're not going to have, whoever's elected is not going to have time to sit on their hands. Our funding models are broken as to how we calculate teachers, teaching aids and stuff like that. We've got to invest more money into teaching and these teaching aids than we currently are. So we've got to really sit down and look at the models. It's like any business, you know, you have management on one hand and you have, you know, labor on the other, or front lines on the other. And it's a real balancing act between management and labor. And I think we've tipped on the management side a little heavy now, and we got to get that labor side, you know, brought up a bit. And that happens, you know, over time with seniority and time in and stuff like that. So we have some real interesting proposals that have come from people about education in rural Alberta and about the funding models and the diversification of these communities. I know we've had our funding for registered apprenticeships cut back, right? And yet the provincial government is harping on more tradespeople, but then they cut the funding for the kids that are in the registered apprenticeship program. I'm going, well, which one is it? Do we want more registered apprentices or do we not? Like, let's make sure this works. We have school divisions that are very profitable and other school divisions that are losing millions of dollars. What? Why? You know, there, somebody really has to look at this. And the other thing that we really got to cut out is this solid line. And I can tell you a story just down the road from us. One set of kids lives on the south side of the road. The other set of kids live on the north side of the road, and they're cousins. But because one's on south side and one's on the north side, two school buses go down that road and pick up those kids, and they go to two separate schools, right? Like, you know, we gotta get some common sense involved in these things. It's all about, oh well, you know, you're getting the $11,000 and I'm not. So yeah, like I said, there's a lot of these things that got to be looked at really hard.
You also talked a little bit about the EMS situation in your town, and that's been getting a lot of news coverage lately as well. You also mentioned that you have an emergency room that's been closed for 2 years. We saw when the UCP were elected, we saw Tyler Shandro come out, and he had a very adversarial tone with healthcare workers, with physicians. We've seen the government proposal for the new contract for HSAA, and that's almost unilaterally cuts across the board. What if anything would you do differently in order to, you know, open up your ER and all of the other things?
Well, it's back to this. I don't know whose idea it is, and maybe it's the unions, and maybe there'll be a fight on there. But there's way too many of these part-time positions. So if you're a university graduate nurse and you're coming out of university and you're looking for a job and you've got $120,000 in student debt and you're looking at moving to a community to become a nurse, you're not going to work 0.4 hours, right? And especially if you only got a temporary contract. All our contracts seem to be temporary. Nobody can get a full-time job anymore. So here you are. Can you buy a house? Can you start a family? Can you pay your student loan? Can you buy a car? Well, you can't buy a car on 0.4 hours going to the bank. And I just heard this story a couple of weeks ago. A teacher who has a 0.7 hours or 7/10 of a job, but it's only temporary. So she goes to rent an apartment. And anyways, the company says, well, we need a letter from your employer saying that you're employed full time, da 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 da. So she goes back to, you know, the person that hired her and says, well, I need a letter. And they said, well, we don't put the letters out till the 15th of September, your contracts, right? And they started on the 1st. Well, okay, now you're working 15 days without a contract. So she cannot even rent an apartment because she cannot get a letter to get to say that she has a job. And she got $100,000 in student loan debt. You know, she's just devastated. She was nearly in tears when I talked to her. So we have to change these things. The people at the top end have got to start thinking about the poor people at the bottom end. We got to, you know, I guess that's why, you know, I've been a boss, but you can go on my Facebook page. I don't ask my guys to do anything that I wouldn't do myself.
Yeah, I saw, when I was checking out your Facebook page earlier today, I saw a picture of you in what appeared to be a very big hole dealing with some kind of pipe of some kind. I don't know
if it was water distribution system. But like I say, I don't ask my guys to do anything that I wouldn't do. I've been in the trenches. I've seen it, you know. So like I say, been there, done that, seen that.
Okay. In regards to EMS, what are some of the solutions that you'd like to see brought to the table to deal with the EMS crisis that we're seeing? Not only, I mean, it's all across the province.
Well, they brought in the centralized dispatch for the EMS, and they tend to roll things out before they have them ready. And that's what's been one of our biggest drawbacks is the dispatch portion of the EMS. We're very fortunate, actually, in our little neighborhood. We still have one of four volunteer ambulances in the province. So we get pretty good response out there. But when you take our ambulances, and I heard this story yesterday, you take one of our ambulances from our community, it's 2.5 hours into Edmonton. It goes to Edmonton. Oh, geez, you're in Edmonton, right on. We could now send you on a transfer from Edmonton to Calgary. Calgary, then they send them to Red Deer. Well, they were 14 hours into their day, and they were still 3 hours from home. And, you know, I went through this with a big corporation, too. They moved their dispatch center to Nova Scotia. And, you know, on Alberta maps, it's not that far if you're in Nova Scotia. You know, and so we got to get some more back to common sense. And I think the biggest problem is we're not listening to the frontline workers. You know, you're not going out and listening to the frontline workers. And that's kind of where these guys have been making references to me of Ralph Klein. You know, Ralph Klein just went places, seen things. He didn't rely on somebody else's opinion. He went and had a look for himself.
All right. Now, there's a couple other topics I want to make sure that we hit on before we sort of talk about the campaign in general. If you were premier, let's say the month before COVID hit, is there anything other than not letting your staff travel internationally when you told everybody to stay home at Christmas? Is there anything that you would have done differently?
Or going into the COVID? Like in advance of the COVID being announced? Okay, our province has always done a very good job of disaster emergency management. We had a lot of things, thanks to the government for having in place. And it's taken 10 years to get some of it in place. When we went into the COVID, the response was excellent. But like I said, as we got 4 to 6 months into it, it maybe just was everybody got worn down. But no, right at the beginning of the COVID, it was good. It's just that sometime along the way, somebody needed to stand up and say, okay, this wasn't as bad as we thought it was going to be, you know. We had the open summer last summer, and then, oh my gosh, we're all back locked down again. And then the problem with that is I don't believe the statistics were really supporting the story. I can tell you one thing about that. We were the hot spot. Our municipality was a hot spot 1 week. We were the absolute hot spot. I panicked phone calls from my CAO and my disaster emergency management team, and they said, my God, you realize we have the most cases of COVID in all of Alberta. And I went to the report and I scrolled through the whole report. Yeah, we had three. But the way they rolled the information out, it made it look like we had 1,478 people with COVID out of 1,600.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to explain when you say the numbers don't match up, because one of the things that's been discussed is there have been a lot of people who have tried to say COVID wasn't that bad. COVID was comparatively mild. We saw the premier of Alberta, Mr. Kenney, stand up in the legislature and try to suggest to Albertans at the beginning that it was just a flu. Looking at the COVID statistics, words are hard sometimes, for today, since COVID started, 4,591 Albertans have died. And if we were to compare that to the flu rates, bearing in mind as well that those numbers are underreported, that's something that everybody has accepted, Alberta Health has accepted, Alberta Health Services accepted, Stats Canada said those numbers are underreported. But we know for sure of 4,591 Albertans who have died because of COVID. The influenza numbers for the last couple of years, prior to that, 2019 to 2020, 39 people died. 2018 to 2019, 30 people died. 2017, 2018, there were a total of 92 people who died. So we would have to roll up the deaths for almost literally 40 years, going back to probably before the, well, maybe if we went back too far, we'd probably not get the flu vaccine. But it's the magnitude is enormous in comparison to any of the other normal causes of death for Albertans. Do you think that the COVID response was too harsh, or that the province should have? I mean, I don't think there's any question that the one theme that I think almost everybody agrees on is that the leadership in the province kind of crapped the bed in regards to providing actual leadership, because as you said yourself, they had their own set of rules. But do you think that the response was too harsh, or that it was just poorly managed or poorly communicated?
Well, you probably can look up my Facebook page, because I think I wrote about it about 3 months into the COVID. There was three things that the Canadian Health Organization put into a mandate back, I do believe it was 1991. Don't quote me on that. Anyways, there's three things you have to look at in the pandemic, because obviously we knew a pandemic was coming. One was the total number of deaths, right? Number two was the economic impact on your society. And number three was the mental impact on the society. And what ended up happening was we forgot about number three. You know, we were working on number two. We were putting all our weight on number one. And I guess, like I said, because I'm in people's homes and that, the mental impact that this has had on our society, I think, you know, like you say, 4,900 people have died from COVID. I question how many people have died from opioid overdoses and suicides. You know, there's a number that has escalated, you know, considerably in the last year. But what is the mental impact going to be for the next 10 years? Because we've got a lot of people that are not going to recover. They were okay for the first year. And then all of a sudden, you know, it just got to be too much for him. You know, and I can tell you, you know, a perfect example was my mother, because she was in the hospital and she just basically, she had no friends, no family could come visit her. She just said to the doctor, I might as well die. You know, I don't have any other life. And we're seeing that in our seniors' homes. Seniors are not going into our home, into extended care anymore, because they want to be with their family. They want to, you know, they want to just die at home. So there's a lot of people not going for, going in for healthcare right now, because they're afraid of the doctors telling them you got COVID. So we had to get a better message out there at one time. And we had to take into consideration that mental health impact.
Okay. I mean, I don't think there's any question. Certainly in the last little while, we've seen opioid overdose deaths overtake the number of COVID deaths that we've been seeing week over week. The suicides, we do have the stats on. Suicides actually went down, thankfully, They did significantly went down during the public health measures, but the opioid crisis. And I think it's I know that if I don't say this, my comments are going to be crazy. But I think it's important to note that the timing of some of the decisions that the provincial government made in regards to how to manage the opioid crisis could not have been worse. Because they eliminated some measures that definitely helped to prevent the loss of life. But since you brought up the opioid crisis, let's get into it. What kind of response would you like to see for the opioid crisis?
Well, the problem we have with the opioid crisis is we keep talking rehabilitation, you know, and rehab facilities. And right now we don't have sufficient facilities to deal with it. And, okay, I'm back to the people making up the rules and coming up with the ideas. I don't know the life. Some of them do. I will admit there are some MLAs I've talked to, and you know they do know the life. But you know, right now there's no consequences for drug dealers, right? I've talked with RCMP officers, and you know, just actually here last week at our Rural Crime Watch meeting. You know, $100,000 drug bust, and the Crown prosecutors tossed it out. He says, well, how are we going to have a, you know, get some sort of control on drugs? He says, if we can't arrest anybody for selling drugs. And the resources we have in rural Alberta for addictions are very, very poor. Like in our area, the only counselors we have in our area currently are the RCMP. Right, we don't have addiction counselors. They're the ones that have to go out and deal with it, or you know, addiction intervention people. And so, if you have mental case issues, it's a 3-hour drive for the RCMP to take them either to Ponoka or St. Paul. And when you don't have any supports for mental health, then you have addiction problems, and then you have opioid problems. And I know the city of Calgary is really struggling in downtown right now. And, you know, the Mustard Seed is doing a wonderful job, but the impact of the volume of people is overwhelming. You know, the Wetaskiwin, I'm sure, you know, you've seen Wetaskiwin's been in the news many, many times. And now, and I've been in the meetings, there's a fight between whose responsibility it is to look after the homeless people and the people, you know, the addictions and stuff. And we have, you know, the federal government saying, oh, it's a provincial government's problem. The provincial government saying it's the municipality's problems. Municipalities don't have the money to deal with 400 or 500 homeless people, you know, that show up one day. And, you know, we've been talking this low income housing projects since 2013. I think across Canada, we've built 2,100 units. Like, you know, there's got to be less talk and more action. And, you know, like, anybody that knows much about rehabilitation, most of our programs in Alberta are 14 or 28 days. Well, if you know somebody who, you know, is addicted to drugs, you know, they're not even detoxed in 14 days. You know, and then they're kicking them back out on the street again. And, you know, especially crystal meth and those, you know, you've got to work. It's 60 days to 6 months. And I don't think we have hardly any programs in the province that are 60 days to 6 months.
I don't disagree with anything that you said there, by and large. We saw early on in the UCP's tenure, they took a very, very hard stance towards supervised consumption sites. Now, obviously, the methodology of a supervised consumption site in a rural setting versus an urban setting are going to be two very, very different beasts. But we saw in Lethbridge, when the supervised consumption site in Lethbridge was shut down, despite the fact that it was shut down over allegations of missing money that wasn't actually missing, deaths skyrocketed after the fact. What are your thoughts on, I mean, the two big hot words in addictions right now are supervised consumption sites and safe supply, which is technically five words. So I'll say the five big words. What are your thoughts on supervised consumption sites and safe supply?
The supervised consumption sites I know too much about. I have one of the guys who worked for me one time. He was a security guard down there, and when you say that the death rate escalated, you know, substantially after they closed this site, he was one of the ones that was, you know, administering, is it naloxone?
Yeah, naloxone or Narcan.
Right, Narcan. And he said there was days he would use that on the same person 5 to 7 times in one day, you know. And like you said, they just, you know, they do it, they get up, they leave, they, you know. And there was a lot of people not inside the site using it. There was a lot more outside than inside. So Lethbridge was a really bad situation. You know, safe supply. Well, there, we need to get back to rehabilitation. And, you know, this is, you know, safe supply and free injection sites are a stopgap for, a bad problem. And maybe we should fix the problem instead of just trying to put patches on it. So, which is, you know, back to mental health, you know. Mental health, you know, homeless people, you know, and let's get back and fix the root problem. You know, like I say, the other two are just stopgaps to make you feel better.
Okay.
I think there would be some that would argue that I mean, I have a joke that I like to use. How many psychologists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is only one, but the light bulb has to want to change. And I think that there's a strong argument to be made that part of getting people the help that they need is getting them it to them in a way that they can accept it. But that's a whole other episode. So we won't get too far into that.
That one we could talk about for days. You know, we have to figure out how we got there, though. We have to figure out how we got there.
And I think one of the things that you would hear from a lot of addictions advocates would be that overwhelmingly people are trying to self-medicate trauma because they don't have the appropriate tools to manage their whatever that trauma is. So I really do. I got to say, I appreciate the fact that you're bringing it back to mental health because that is such a big component of it.
And then the problem I see right now is that it's going to take a generation to fix this problem.
Oh yeah, at least.
Because we have those people who grew up in these, you know, in these homes, and we're trying to help them to get out of those homes, which is back to education, which is back to having proper teaching assistance, having proper supports in the schools, will help solve some of these problems. And, you know, like I say, you get a kid that falls through the cracks where he doesn't get the attention at school and doesn't get the help he needs at school, he's going to find the help. And unfortunately, sometimes that's in a pipe or a bottle.
I don't disagree. One of the other biggest issues, and it's probably the one that we've seen candidates for the UCP leadership largely lean into, has to do with the question of the province's relationship with the federal government. So what's your take on that?
Well, we've been saying that for a long time, you know, so I'm going to put a couple of plugs in here for this. Hey, if a small town mayor is willing to take on the UCP leadership and the provincial government, do you think I'm going to back down from Justin Trudeau? Not going to happen. You know, the other thing is if you vote for Rachel Notley, you're voting for Justin Trudeau again.
Well,
because the NDP's policy book is Canada-wide, and Jagmeet Singh has joined Trudeau, so therefore Notley is following his playbook. So there you go. You vote for Notley, you're voting for Justin Trudeau.
Now you're sounding like a UCP leadership candidate. But no, in all seriousness, we saw Danielle Smith. She has tried to make a lot of hay over this business of something she's calling the Alberta Sovereignty Act.
Yes.
Let's go there. What's your thoughts?
It's a long road. It's a long road. I went to the Fair Deal panel hearings, not just once. I went three times. I went to three different Fair Deal panel hearings and listened to what the people had to say. Some of the stuff that was in the report, I'm going, well, they must have gone to different meetings than I went to, because I didn't hear any of that in the report, but that's okay. There's a lot of things we can do for ourselves that we haven't been standing up for. You know, our own pension plan in Alberta, our own EI system in Alberta, our own revenue agency in Alberta, the police force one, I'm back and forth on that. If we're going to separate, we had to have our own police force, which we're not going to separate, I don't believe, a long ways down the road. But look at what Quebec gets. So why are we not doing what Quebec does, so that we're getting our fair share, like Quebec gets their fair share, or our fair share, Quebec gets our share. So people want to have a referendum, but they got to make sure they understand what the question is. That's a big thing. Everybody says, oh, you know, we're going to have this referendum and we're going to vote to separate from Canada. Well, that's the first step. They have to understand how many more steps are after that. And the worst problem is that you have to have a majority of your province has to agree to it, right? And this is the next problem. When we don't get 80% of the population out to vote in the general election, I can't see us getting 80% of the people out to vote on a sovereign, you know, on a referendum. But yeah, there are a lot of things we can do. I guess what it boils down to, we seem to keep bringing people from federal politics to Alberta. Now, whether we bring them because they're sent here, which like Jim Prentice and, you know, rest his soul, I met him a couple of times. Who's a banker that leaves the CIBC and spends $2.1 million to become the premier of a province for $240,000 a year? He was sent here by the East to get us calmed down a little bit because we're getting out of hand. The Sovereignty Act we need to look into them. We need to get the best fair deal for our province. Okay. And I don't think our current or previous governments have really stood up to Ottawa.
So I understand I've lived in Alberta all of my life. I have grown up under the constant narrative of we have to stand up to Ottawa. So I hear where you're coming from on that. I guess where I kind of would like to know more about your stance on the Sovereignty Act is, Danielle Smith, she is one of the higher profile candidates currently, I'll say cautiously. And she has taken a lot of heat, and there's constitutional lawyers and constitutional scholars across the country who have basically said the Sovereignty Act, as she's proposing it, and as a couple of other people have talked about, is not only just not possible from a legal standpoint, but there are people who are raising the question, if we start to pick and choose. I mean, at the beginning of our conversation, you said that, you know, if there's laws that you don't like, there's ways to work to change them. And if we start to pick and choose what laws we're going to follow, that sets a very dangerous tone for how we're going to manage a civil society.
Yes. Yeah. Like I say, I do have some issues with some of that. There's the Clarity Act. I don't know whether you've read the Clarity Act. It's the Supreme Court ruling as to separation of a province from Canada. And if you follow the Clarity Act through its entirety from start to finish, I don't believe that there would ever be a province separate from Canada. There's a lot of negotiating that needs to be had. And the thing is we got to start negotiating on both sides fairly. And that's where I don't think we're negotiating. I don't believe Ottawa is negotiating with us fairly on some things. I know some people like Brian Jean is saying, let's go to Ottawa and let's get this fixed. And Daniel Smith is saying, let's get the people are saying get the Constitution rewritten. I do believe there's some middle ground there. I guess because I'm in the business I'm in, I negotiate contracts, you know, every day. When I come to work at your home, I have to negotiate, you know, what I'm going to deliver and what you're going to get and what your expectations are. And I don't think that's been happening. I think what's been happening is, you know, we've been going to Ottawa with our hat in our hand and saying, you know, can we have some scraps here and we'll be okay, when we really should be going down there and saying, okay, you're getting $15 billion a year from our oil and gas industry. You know, we want concessions on our oil and gas industry to build pipelines, to get through Quebec, to, you know, feed the Atlantic provinces. Or, you know, maybe we'll just quit, you know, shipping oil and gas, and then your $15 billion is gone. You know, look at Quebec. They sell more, well, nearly as much hydropower as we do oil and gas. That's not negotiated in the, you know, in the equalization payments, because it's owned by Quebec Hydro. Well, okay, the oil is owned by Alberta Oil, you know, and sold to the oil companies, and, you know, and we're going, oh no, we don't make any money off of that. Yeah, no, there are a lot of things we can do. You know, we're a rich province, and like I say, Canada Pension, you know, EI, Revenue Agency, Police Force. So those things we can do fairly quickly, fairly fastly, at very little cost, which then sets the tone to, now let's negotiate, you know. And, you know, if you don't have a power, you know, a place of strength to negotiate, you're never going to get what you want in a contract, you know. And I guess ultimately, any negotiation, you have to be willing to walk away from the table too, which is where you're talking separatism.
I'm curious. I mean, when we first started this section of the conversation, you talked about how you were going back and forth on the provincial police force. And there's certainly, I don't even know if I could rationalize calling it lukewarm support for a provincial police force based on the provincial polling. I mean, the numbers are in the 30%. And the last polling data that I saw indicated that they were hardening in those places. There wasn't a whole lot of movement going on. What would be, and we saw as well, there's the town whose name escapes me, but Mr. Shadrow was making a big deal out of them just recently because he was trying to say, they're not getting any of the federal benefit. They're having to pay for the whole thing themselves. But that happened because they walked away from the RCMP.
Right. Burnaby, BC.
Oh, no, it was in Alberta.
Oh, in Alberta. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I probably could find the name, but I want to pay attention. So, you know, with not even tepid support from a provincial police force from the population of Alberta, and with test cases that seem to show if it doesn't work out, you end up paying more. What's the benefit?
Well, I'm a big supporter of the RCMP. And when they came out with this provincial police force thing, I kind of was going, yeah, okay. I kind of see that. So I was a big supporter of the RCMP and keeping the RCMP. And then we went through a bunch of information center sessions for municipal officials and stuff. And there was a lot of stuff brought to light to us that I'm going, okay, we got a problem here. We got to look at this provincial police force thing. Our contract is up in 2032 with the RCMP, right? To renegotiate the contract, we negotiated through the federal government. The only contract we can negotiate on our side is there's 10 provinces that 100% have to agree on that contract before the federal government will sign their side once you reach an agreement. So you got to have 10 people agree on something that the federal government's gave you. That's a problem right there, I see. The next problem is the federal government hasn't been negotiating fairly with provinces for the last while. So where would we believe that in an RCMP contract that the federal government is going to negotiate well with us on that, right? And we've seen what happened with this retroactive pay, where, you know, the federal government downloaded on the provincial government, who then turned around and downloaded it on the municipalities with no warning. They just sent the bill out and said, here, you know, you owe $683,000 for the last 10 years of policing, you know, and municipalities didn't have that kind of money. So there's a negotiation. And then I believe in the negotiation process, the federal government is going to leverage the provinces against the union and say, oh, we can't give you this because the provinces don't want it. And then they'll come back, tell the provinces, oh, this is what they want. You know how it is, leverage in contracts. The other thing is the federal government, in the meetings I was in, made it very, very clear, the federal government wants to get out of community policing, right? And okay, so you got 10 years to get this done, put in a provincial police force. What a lot of people don't realize is that, oh, the RCMP is still going to be in Alberta looking after all of the federal crime. So there'll be still nearly 500 of their 2,000 members will still be in Alberta, you know, looking after, you know, federal crimes, murders, breaking enders, and that sort of stuff. So, yeah, you're the provincial police force thing is we need to prepare ourselves for community policing down the road. So we do need to get the information. We need to get it right.
It's interesting. There's so much mixed messaging on the future of the RCMP because, you know, that's not the first time that I've heard the idea that the RCMP are wanting to get out of community policing. But at the same time, they just released their statement last week, I think it was, where they said they want to build better relationships with the communities and add more members. So I think you're 100% bang on in regards to we need to make sure that especially the RCMP are communicating clearly what their intent is.
Yeah, I think that's more of a federal thing, getting out of community policing. Like the RCMP has really switched their mandates in the last, well, since I've been around the last 8 years, I've seen a real swing about 6-7 years ago, where we're one of the very few communities in Alberta that has a community policing association that meets with the RCMP and makes recommendations, and we get statistics every month. So that was one of the things that we brought up about 6 years ago. You guys are not doing a very good job of getting out in the community and being recognized in the community. And, you know, I've noticed a big change in the last 4 years, actually.
Okay. Well, that's good news.
So there we are. You know, have a problem, you know, yell about it, bring up a solution, somebody fixes it.
There we go. I have one more question that I have to ask you about, then I want to hear about the campaign. I hope I'm not taking up too much of your time, but it's Premier of the province is a pretty big topic. So now I've noticed in your social media that you have been very positive about an organization called the Alberta Prosperity Project.
Yes. I like some of their stuff, not all of it.
Okay. I have some questions because we saw this week circulating on social media, one of their vice presidents released I don't know what to call it because it was very bad. There was a lot of rhetoric that was used in there that a lot of people, and I don't mind saying myself included, found really quite offensive, especially targeting the LGBTQ2S+ community. Now, one of the things that I find particularly intriguing about the Alberta Prosperity Project is that they're very clear that right now they're operating more kind of as a PAC or political action committee. They're holding rallies, they're trying to influence the conversation, but they also very clearly want to be a political party. They have released policies, they have released bylaws. I strongly suspect they're just in the process of collecting signatures. There's a dissonance for me in you're running to be the leader of the UCP, and at the same time you're saying, well, these Alberta Prosperity guys, they're good too.
Yeah, well Dennis Beaudry and I had a fairly long conversation here a week and a half ago, and he was saying the same thing. Oh no, we're not a political party, we'll never be a political party. We're here to you know, we're here to get the idea of, you know, prosperity ideas out. And then I read through their policies. I sat through their meetings. I know some of their people.
Has Dennis been on their website?
You know, they may be doing some maneuvering, but it's like many of these organizations, they got some good ideas. You got to listen to all the good ideas and then kind of weed out. There's a few, every one of them I've read, I've gone, well, you know, I really like this and I really like that, but boy, this has got to go because you guys are way out there, you know?
Yeah.
And
if you scroll to the bottom of their website for our listeners and our viewers, there's a section called Research and Documents, and it's literally the third point down is proposed party bylaws, followed by proposed constituency association rules. So I'm sorry that it's just so entertaining to me that the president would be like, no, we're not trying to be a political party.
Yeah, yeah. This is where you've got to listen to everybody's ideas, and you have to use some common sense, because there's about five organizations that are all sitting. They got three or four points that are exactly the same. Well, and the same people have started three or four of them, and then they get mad and they move over here, and this person gets mad and moves over there, and they start something new, which is where we're at with the UCP and the WIPA and the TIPS and you know, well, I guess I belong to the Wild Rose, which was a break off from the PC party. But, you know, there's a lot of these guys, they all got the same message, but then they got to put in two or three things that are obscure that I can't agree with everything that they say. Like I said, I've come out strongly as to, you know, a bunch of the stuff of the APP, you know, and the Sovereignty Act also, you know, I've come out strongly saying that they've got a lot of good points too, but there's just some that are not actionable. But
how would you manage? I mean, one of the things that a lot of people are looking at with this leadership race, and certainly one of the biggest jobs for whoever wins it, is going to be repairing the split in the party. There's very clearly a component of the party that is more in the PC vein, and there's very clearly a component of the party that is even more passionate than the Wild Rose were. I'm trying to be real generous here. There's some folks with some interesting ideas that are not founded on anything, I think, other than emotion. How would you keep those two things inside of the same tent? Because that's clearly something that Mr. Kenny failed to do.
Well, I don't know. Some of this falling apart was due to COVID and not being able to have good meetings and you know, conventions. Conventions seem to always bring people together. Yeah, how do you bring both parties together? We both have our own personal ideas. You know, we're seeing a split with the MLAs. And I think the problem is that it turned into a top-down driven association. And, you know, what people were looking for was associations where you could have more of the constituency ideas taken to your MLA, who then would, you know, take it to the caucus, who would then take it, you know, and the leader and get it into the legislature. And, you know, I've seen this happen. We had it, you know, had it happen before where, you know, a CA gets a guy nominated, gets a guy elected, and then the guy never shows up at another meeting. He's elected now. I don't need to come back. And I think that's where we got to get back to is listening to the people, you know, the working people of Alberta, the people that are struggling in Alberta right now. And I think somewhere we've lost that disconnect. And you have to, not all of regions want the same thing, right? Like we talked about that in our region about the social distancing, you know, and the lockdowns and family members. Well, you know, if you're from around Fairview, you know, some of them families are 200 people, you know, more. And so, and where was I going with this? You gotta listen to the people at the bottom, and it's gotta be, they gotta have a good flow of information on the way up and a good flow of information on the way down. And nobody can be muzzled at either end, you know, and that's, I think, where a lot of the people are upset, because nobody is listening to them, let alone hearing them, right? You know, there's lots of, oh, we're doing this, we're doing that, but we're not listening and we're not hearing. And, you know, I'll go back to my council experience. We actually had our public open forum here where we released our financial statement 2 weeks ago. And because people had talked to us on the street about it, nobody came to the meeting because they said, well, you know, you guys just talk about it anyways. And, you know, if we got a problem, we come, you know, we've come to the office or we come to the meeting and we complain. And that's where the disconnects happen, is that the people aren't talking to their MLAs, or MLAs are not able to freely talk within caucus. And, you know, and the information's got to go back down the same ways. We have a, you know, don't want to bring it up, but I should. We have a very good federal, you know, EDA in our region, where our MP in parliament, no matter where he is, meets with them every month. But during the truckers convoy, they had more than one meeting. There was talk that, and I wasn't on the inside, so don't take this as fact. They were talking to having a meeting every day as to the best way to support one way or the other what they needed to do. So you got to get that information from the people. That's why you have an elected official, so that you can go to his office. And I've heard this many times. Oh, well, they don't listen to me in the office. You need to be able to go to their office. You need to be able to talk to someone, and preferably your MLA at one time or not. And then that MLA needs to be able to take that concern to Edmonton and speak freely about it. You know, and not be, like I say, no censorship.
Now, you've described yourself as the wild card in this election race. And certainly when the rules were announced, there were some people who said, oh, there's no way Bill's going to be able to get the money together. You're confident that you're going to. How's the campaign been so far? I mean, I have to be forthcoming. We did have a little bit of a preamble conversation before we started recording proper. And it sounds like there are some people who are not treating you on the same level playing field. What's going on?
Well, yeah, like I said, I put my name in because I was upset. And now the amount of support I have gotten from across the province, whether it's messaging, Facebook, I do believe we're at over 1,000 followers in just over a week. That's fairly reasonable for something that's unknown. I've got invitations. I'm on my way to Fort McMurray on Friday, Grand Prairie on Sunday. Back down to Tabor next week. Plus, I got a whole tour through the center of the thing. But yeah, because it's all MLAs or ex-MLAs in there, they seem to think that that's the only person that can be a leader is somebody that's been an MLA. Jim Brendis wasn't an MLA. He came along and whatever happened there, you know. But yeah, I'm not being recorded in the polls. I'm the other in the polls, which I'm polling very good as other, because they got the other seven names, and then there's other, and the only other is me. I'm polling better than most of them on some of them.
The last poll I saw, I think the majority of Albertans were 44% for others. So there you go.
That's actually what my wife was saying. She said, you know, you know, like I said, you know, I don't want to bash the MLAs, but, like, you know, in the hierarchy of the world, the premier and me are the same, except I got more power than the premier because I can write laws. I was just actually telling an MLA this we had an issue in our little town in the RCMP. We don't have a law to enforce that. And I said, well, what law do you need? And he kind of told me what I needed and phoned my CAO. I said, we need to write a law. Phoned the other two counselors. We wrote a law. Half an hour later, they arrested the guy. That's maybe too much power, but that's what the people of the community wanted us to do, because he was going to burn our town down. And then, like I say, I'm the other in the polls. So which I'm okay with, because maybe you go back to Brewster's Million, where none of the above wins.
if you remain as other in the polls, would you be looking at a run for MLA? Are you going to stay mayor? Is there a game plan? What does it look like if there is one?
Well, there'll be a game plan, I'm sure, after this. The reason I didn't run in the last election is I looked at some issues that we were dealing with at the municipal levels. And I honestly believe that I could do more good at the municipal level, getting involved heavily in the municipal level, than I could if I moved up into the provincial level. So that's why I didn't run in the last election. And that may be the case again, come this next election. If I don't win this bid, I may end up, in a different position in the municipal level of the world.
Okay.
I'm going to go where I can do the most good, or I believe I can do the most good.
Okay. Is there anything else you want people to hear? Is there anything else you want people to know?
Yeah, we got a thing going on here. You got to follow us on Facebook. I think you're going to get Instagram up and running. My granddaughter made me a rock for Father's Day last year. It's a special rock. It travels with me in my truck. We call it the Lock Rock. So the Lock Rock, you should got to keep me company in my truck when I'm working. So the Lock Rock is going to travel Alberta. We're going to get our Instagram account up. We're going to get GPS on Lock Rock, and you're going to be able to follow us across the province.
I did see pictures of Lock Rock earlier today. It's a handsome rock.
It's a she,
Oh, she's a very...
She's beautiful, yes.
Yeah, beautiful lady rock. That could turn into a whole other conversation.
we gotta bring some fun back into politics. We gotta bring some respect back into politics. You know, when I was a kid, it was an honor to go and meet the premier of the province and your MLA and the MP. And now, people across the street to avoid talking to them. And we gotta bring some honor back into the whole game.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us tonight. And we will definitely be following your campaign. We've got a few months left. Maybe we will have to come back and revisit in a little while.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate the work that the media does for getting the message out. You guys do great work.
I don't know that we count as media, but I'll take it.
Well, your media, you're getting the message out.
There we go. Okay. Thank you so much, Bill.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
As always, if you appreciate the kind of content that we're trying to produce here at The Breakdown, we would love it if you swung by our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/thebreakdownab and signed up for a small monthly sponsorship of the work that we're trying to do here. It is because of the support that we receive from our Patreon sponsors that we're able to continually up our game, and it is tremendously appreciated. So I want to throw a big thank you out to them, and you can go ahead and visit that website and join and support us as well, because we need all the help we can get. Thank you so much for your attention. Thank you so much for listening and being a part of these important conversations. And we will see you next time on The Breakdown.